Welcome to the Social Expedition. Fueling your digitally social experience. Produced by LunaWeb, this is show number 42, August 19th, 2010. Well, we're doing something a little bit different today. Dave is actually on the other side of the country in Seattle at the PII 2010 conference, and he's going to tell you a little bit more about that, and we're going to cut right to him.
Hi, this is Dave Barger with LunaWeb, here at a special edition of the Social Expedition at the PII 2010 conference in Seattle, Washington. And it is the PII stands for Privacy, Identity, and Innovation. We've been mentioning this particular conference ever since March, when I ran into Natalie Fonseca, the co-founder of PII 2010 over at South by Southwest. And these outtakes with these individuals, some of them are obviously social related, but some of them are more on the privacy side, and it's not as obvious, but it really is an underlying foundation ingredient of the social networks, the privacy component to this thing. And it's something that we need to be thinking seriously about and understanding what we want to do rather quickly before moving forward, because these technologies and these industries are not waiting on us to figure out what we want to do with privacy. They're marching forward, and it definitely deserves your thoughts. So hope you enjoy these outtakes. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.
The first interview we've got for you today is Andrew McGuire with Intern Match. So we're going to cut right to that.
I'm here after the Pitch Slam competition talking to one of the winners. Actually, you were the second runner-up here, Andrew McGuire of Intern Match.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me.
And this has been a real interesting evening, because you started off in the quick pitch, mm-hmm. and then you escalated up into being up here on the final panel, and then you came in as a runner-up. So you must have an awesome idea here in the cooker. Tell us a little bit about Intern Match.
Yeah, so Intern Match helps college students find internships. And it's born out of the idea and the fact that as recent students ourselves, we sort of experienced this problem where everyone was talking about going and working at the same few big companies. And we knew that, you know, people had different interests and experience, and there's so many different organizations where you could go, but there was really no mechanism in place that effectively helped them connect with each other. So we said, we're gonna build this, we're gonna create this. And so we moved to Seattle from the East Coast, and we started this company, and the first thing we did was we sat down with hundreds of employers and got their feedback. And really just got the ball rolling, and we've created a solution now where we have the most internships in Washington State and more than most other resources combined.
Wow.
And now we're looking to, we've sort of made an internal transition to more scalable strategies. We started off, really using the shoe leather, but now we have strategies in place that are going to allow us to expand. So we're going to Oregon and California mm-hmm. in September, and after that, the sky's the limit, and we'll be looking to expand nationally.
Now you had a good question posed to you about barriers to entry from other competitors. Mm-hmm. And what is your response to that? Because this is a great idea.
I mean, So we see our competitors as sort of three distinct groups, right? One is the sort of ingrained on-campus recruiting, and that's just enormously inefficient. It takes a lot of time. It's inherently limited in terms of the number of companies that can participate, but it's very ingrained and it's institutionalized. But we think that we can, it's inevitable that this is going digital, and there's so much potential there. Another group is the sort of 800-pound gorilla, the monster, the career builder. They haven't really effectively targeted this niche. Mm-hmm. And part of the reason is that they sort of go with the build it and they will come. But, unlike jobs, people aren't willing to just pick up and go intern on the other side of the country. So you need to build these local networks, and then you can build more relevant local networks so that we go to the Bay Area next, and then students who go to UW go home for the summer and they can go to San Francisco, but you need the local opportunities for when students are in school. And so it's really important to understand the factors that are very specific to internships, to focus on the niche, to focus on the educational materials. And that's something that these big companies don't really have the flexibility to do. We can also make ourselves defensible, not only with a sort of first mover advantage, but also by taking all of the data and the interactions that happen on our site and using that to become increasingly intelligent and sophisticated about what we recommend to students and what we recommend to employers. And that's something where you can't just throw millions of dollars at an algorithm and on day one be that good. You need the data. You need to know that students who looked at this also looked at this and ended up interning at, you know, a third place. And taking that over time makes us defensible to competitors.
Outstanding. What would you say to somebody who has an idea, who's looking at getting out there with their idea?
Who's looking to start
yeah,
a company?
Yeah.
I would say that there are a couple things. One, a million people are going to tell you that you can't do it. And what you need to do is, you know, you need to be really thoughtful and careful about your idea and let it evolve and listen to feedback, but you also have to persevere, right? There are always going to be people that are going to shoot you down, but if you can get over that first hump, then you're going to find some really smart, amazing people that are going to encourage you and help you, and you should seek them out, especially the ones that have information that's specific to what you're trying to do.
Fantastic. So is this your first idea?
Yes. So I graduated from Columbia University a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
4 days after I graduated, I packed my bags and moved to Seattle and started InternMatch. So, yeah.
Well, Andrew, hey, thanks for the insights. And where can we find you guys online?
InternMatch.com.
Okay.
Yep.
All right. Have a good one.
Thanks.
Thank you.
And that was Andrew McGuire with InternMatch. You can find them online at InternMatch.com or on Twitter at InternMatch. And keeping with the finding a job theme, we're going to talk to Carmen Hudson with Tweet a Job.
Well, hey, I'm fortunate enough to catch up with Carmen Hudson from Tweet a Job.
Absolutely.
At tweetajob.com and I guess at Tweet a Job, no doubt.
Absolutely. At Tweet a Job, at PeopleShark is my personal Twitter.
PeopleShark.
PeopleShark. I adopted that name for my blog years and years ago, so it became my Twitter name before I decided I'd have a startup.
So we go to PeopleShark.com. There's your blog's there?
People-shark at blogspot.com.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right. Wait, hey, tell us about Tweet a Job.
Sure. So launched Tweet a Job in November 2009. Company was born a little bit before that, about 6 months prior to that. And it was just born out of this idea that we needed to make Twitter a lot more accessible to recruiters who may not know how to use Twitter, and a lot easier to use for job seekers who are getting a lot of job spam, unrelated jobs. And so what we do is we take jobs from employers, real jobs, and we distribute them to job seekers based on their location and their career interests. So we send only specific tweets to job seekers who sign up at www.tweetajob.com.
Now, okay, so when you say you send them to them, are you talking about you make these...
We tweet them to their Twitter timelines and or their mobile phone.
And so they're following you based on geographic location?
Yes. So if you visit our website, you would select your location as mm-hmm. well as one of 28 job categories in which you might have an interest. So if you're interested in web development jobs mm-hmm. and you're located in Memphis,
right.
You make those two selections. And then the only jobs that we tweet to you would be web dev jobs in the Memphis metropolitan area.
Okay. Great. Now, do you do stuff for the candidates as well?
So that is for candidates. That's absolutely for candidates. It's absolutely free for candidates, for mm-hmm. job seekers to use. And recruiters and employers, they pay the fees.
Right.
And they're out there, they're obviously trying to reach candidates via Twitter. We mm-hmm. help them make a little bit more sense of the tool.
And you used a great phrase, I loved it, called job pollution.
Yes. So I mentioned this during the pitch, but if you just do a search on pound jobs on Twitter, you'll see 200-300, sometimes at peak hours, 500 jobs per minute being posted to Twitter.
Yeah.
There's no way any one Twitter user can keep up with this amount of information.
Oh, no.
And even if you follow a particular company and they're tweeting jobs all over the country or all over the world in job categories that are interesting to you, you're getting a lot of job pollution, job spam that's not interesting to you.
Yeah.
So what we do is simplify that for both the recruiters and the job seekers.
Now, where do the headhunters fit in on this?
Headhunters are tweeting through TweetAjob as well.
Okay.
They have jobs. They need to find people. They need to find specific people. We like to make sure, though, that the jobs are real jobs. And so we're very aware of who our customers are, our employers. And so even if they're representing another company, we like them to say that within the job tweet, or at least provide specific contact information.
Okay. That is great. And you guys, where are you located at?
Seattle.
Oh, yeah. Okay. This is your home.
I'm at home. I've been living in Seattle 12 years now.
Excellent. What do you make about the Seattle Geek Week going on?
Love it. Love, you know, the only disappointment is that the president was not able to attend any of the Geek Week events. and we tried a small campaign to make that happen.
Well,
he's
yeah.
pretty busy now.
Yeah, oh, yeah, no doubt.
But I have a sense that he's a closet geek.
I wonder how many phones is he up to now? Or is he still a BlackBerry man?
Yeah,
right?
I want to get that special, you know, encrypted BlackBerry that he has.
Well, tell us one more time real quick. Where can we find you?
You can find me at www.tweetajob.com. Mm-hmm. So job seekers and employers can go there and get information. You can find us on Twitter. Follow our Twitter account for certain. It's @tweetajob. We don't tweet jobs. We actually tweet information for job seekers at that account. If you want to get jobs, go to our website, sign up, tell us your location, your career interests, and we'll send you only specific jobs.
You know, you'd mentioned, you know, some those big companies like Monster and some of these other companies, you know, and I know they have outrageous fees, you know.
Absolutely.
And I think you caught my ear with some pricing that you had shared there. Can you just let us know real quick kind of what ballpark we're talking about so that people can...
If you're an employer, it costs you only $30 to tweet your job as well as post it to our website.
That's awesome.
For a month. So,
that's awesome.
We're going to blow up the whole industry. That's our goal.
All right, Carmen. Thanks so much, Carmen.
Thanks, Dave.
Once again, that website was tweetajob.com, or you can find them on Twitter at @tweetajob, or you can find Carmen Hudson personally on Twitter at @peopleshark. And our next interview is with Becky Pesley of Common Data Project.
Well, I'm lucky enough to catch up with Becky Pesley here with the Common Data Project. And you were just telling me of some very interesting things about what your organization does. And I thought it would be great, and I appreciate you taking the time to talk with us and tell us what is that here, and why should we care?
Well, thanks for asking. we're a young organization, and what we want to do is create a community around sharing data openly, which a lot of people are doing that, but we think one of the ways we're differentiating ourselves is that we want to do it with sensitive information. So we believe that earlier we heard Mark Davis talk about this new digital economy where data is the currency. And the best analogy that I can make to that is that we would want to act like a taxation system in that new digital economy where people are going to be banking, buying, selling, exchanging data and making money off of that. And so shouldn't they be taxed and have to give data back to the community such that the community could benefit from that? So smaller organizations that don't have the benefit of having all that data could use it, and individuals could access it. And so we're working with people who know a lot about differential privacy, which is essentially a mathematical, computational way of adding noise to data such that you can have access to the data and its statistical meaning without actually looking directly at the data and compromising people's privacy.
I gotcha.
Yeah.
So okay, let's say, like, for me example, I'm 46 years old. I go buy a car. And the data that's available is my name, my age, my gender, the car that I bought, probably what I paid for it and the taxes on it and that kind of thing.
Right.
And this, when you're talking about this differential thing.
Right.
It's called what privacy?
Differential privacy.
Differential privacy.
Yeah. It's just, it's a field of technology that a lot of people are involved with now. Mm-hmm. And it's a body of research that basically is trying to think about how can you query data, you know, because data is stored in a database. How can you query it in ways where you can still learn from the information but not see directly what the data points are?
Okay.
So the idea being that, let's say you can start aggregating data about people and their community. So I know that I can look at a map and know that a bunch of people went and had healthcare at this place and are recovering from whatever that ailment is. So maybe a bunch of cancer patients, you know, of a certain gender, of a certain age, who live in a certain community, going to different hospitals. Which, how many are getting better? How many are not getting better? How many are dying? Without knowing that specifically you, Dave, you know, who are 55 or whatever, that live at this house and make this much money.
46.
Okay. Who are that exact person that's part of that data set. So you yourself aren't compromised and aren't necessarily, you know, having people know things about you that you may or may not want them to know. But you're still your community. And people who are making decisions to serve your community are benefiting from the fact that you're in that data set.
Okay. So the noise you're talking about is removing the specifics about me and just kind of making me a little more generic and making that data available to smaller companies who don't have a budget to go out and maybe buy that specific data, which I guess is going to go for a nice premium.
You would think. Yeah.
So our my company is a LunaWeb. And we've got 10 employees. So you're saying like a small company like that would be able to use an organization like yours or your organization is trying to make it so that that kind of data is available to smaller
companies. Yes. I mean, think especially about nonprofits even. Like the nonprofits almost a better example of these small organizations that can't even afford IT infrastructure, maybe can't afford to have large surveys done to advance whatever they are trying to do to serve their community, or even the government, who may be struggling with budgetary constraints around how to serve their communities and doing data. For example, so really interesting, NHANES is a survey that was sponsored by the CDC.
Okay. That's the Center for Disease Control.
Yes.
CDC. Okay.
That CDC. And they ran this very comprehensive study to project health trends for the next whatever many years. Their methodology was very intense, where they sat down and like interviewed people very intimately about, you know, their lifestyle, their eating habits, all of that. That said, they, you know, they were only able to sample like tens of thousands of people. Take that and juxtapose that to the fact that Facebook, maybe they don't know everything that you eat and how, your lifestyle, but they have data about 140 million people.
Right.
Right?
Sure.
And so wouldn't it be cool if like the CDC or a nonprofit or even a small company who wanted to serve the community better or project health trends or whatever it is that they want to do, could do that more easily by sharing data? There's another really interesting example that I think exemplifies what we could do. So the New York Times currently just recently put an article out about some Alzheimer's research that happened, where drug companies, researchers, hospitals all collaborated and agreed to share their research openly with each other to advance the knowledge about Alzheimer's. They realized that they were up against this problem where they were all siloed, all collecting their proprietary data weren't going to get anywhere with the problem until they agreed to work together. Okay. And so they funded this multi-million dollar project, and the New York Times article talks about how it's just been really, really successful for them. And so we think that it would be really interesting to apply technology to that, to make that scenario available to people who maybe can't fund multi-million dollar projects or don't know how to logistically put together a collaborative project like that.
Okay.
So that's the I think long-term, that's the scenario that we're really looking to try to solve.
And these are non-competing organizations that work together, or were they traditional competitors?
If you think about, you know, or maybe competitors, not competitors, maybe just organizations that wouldn't typically have the same interests in mind, right? So like they all have their own agenda for making money. Data right now is very valuable. Like, oh my God, drug companies are going to give up their data to you know, researchers who want to claim patents and sell those patents to the drug companies who make the drugs and then make money, right? Like, what? We're going to like openly give each other data and work together. So it's not, it just was, I think, just not the way people tend to think. And it's somewhat competitive, but somewhat you know, I don't know what you call that.
When I know the word that we've been using for when they're direct competition is co-opetition.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so I think that's a great word.
We're seeing that, that whole co-opetition thing kind of spill into a lot of different industries. Even for us, we're a web agency, and trying to get together almost a peer group of other web agency owners to kind of get together. And so, because you can compete yourself to death.
Right.
And I guess with the data, you know, maybe you don't compete yourself to death, but you could, I guess, all realize a much greater benefit if you share, and that's what you're trying to put together.
We're trying to make that a lot easier and also a lot safer. Right. I think today this conference really gets to the heart of the fact that this notion of privacy is very subjective.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's and also people don't even understand what's known about them today. And that mm-hmm. People, I think, would be horrified if they knew how much is known about them or how much information's about them out there, right? And so I think in some ways, maybe as a society, like, we take advantage of the fact that people kind of unknowingly submit themselves into these institutions or use these products and sort of unknowingly, willingly give their data.
Yeah.
And I think what we're saying is that you can get the same benefit of people participating and giving their data and protect them better and keep the data more private than it even is today. Because I think some people equate real privacy with like a lockdown and limited access to the data, and we're really trying to create a situation where both can be true.
Okay. Yeah. So Becky, what's your words of wisdom to a consumer, just a layman, about who's online? I don't know, on the privacy side of things, you know, what's like, you know, do you have a words of caution? You know, hey, don't do this. Is there any specific thing that you can share with us that's if it was an elevator conversation, is like, okay, tell me real quick, what do I need to be doing on the privacy thing? Anything come to mind there?
I don't know that I do have words of wisdom or that I'm the right person to be giving it, but I think my personal philosophy, which I think applies, is that you have to be accountable for yourself and to yourself. Mm-hmm. So when you think about getting online, and especially when it comes to interacting with people on the web, be it email or searching for things or Facebooking or Twittering, whatever it might be, I think you need to really think about, like, can I feel good about myself the way I'm acting in this situation? And would I be, you know, can I take accountability for what I'm doing and the implication it might have on others? Like, not just me, but what are my actions doing and having an effect on my community? Because that happens in real life. And I think all the online world is doing is like putting that squarely in our faces in a way that it not isn't normally.
Okay.
So I don't know, my words of wisdom is just like, just think about what you're doing and apply common sense, which I don't know if that's very good advice, but that's kind of the intent behind it.
Yeah, and sometimes some people don't know what their common sense may be getting them into trouble sometimes.
Yeah, so. I mean, it's so hard, right? Because a lot of what we talk about here is like, well, people don't know. They don't understand the technology and how it works and what the implications, even if they use good judgment, mm-hmm. they may not really even understand technically the implications of, oh, when I link up my Twitter to my Facebook, what that really means. Who knows? I don't really know, but I think, you know, in general, like, I don't think there's advice that says, like, go read privacy policies. Mm-hmm. There isn't advice about, like, I'm not going to say go learn technologies and figure out and know what you're doing before you do it. Like, you know, for the most part, it's a safe place. It's good. Like, the web is a good place. You know, there's so much, for every bad story, I think there's more good stories about what the web enables mm-hmm. and the people it connects and really what it does for the world. I mean, in this conference, heard a lot of people talking about like America and American values and American business. And really, on the internet, we have to be talking about the world. That's a really awesome thing. So definitely it's a great way to reach out, but you just have to be careful the way you would walking down the street or mm-hmm. doing anything else, you know?
So Becky, how long have you been in this space of privacy realm?
Well, officially 2 months with the Common Data Project.
Okay.
But, you know, and more generally, I've been the people at the Common Data Project, I've been talking with them for a couple of years now about what they're doing and staying on top of that. And previously worked at Microsoft and was the privacy champion for the products that I worked on.
Wow.
So know a lot. I actually, one of the things that we think we provide value in, you know, being a group of people working on this problem is that we all collectively have a lot of experience dealing with privacy practices, best practices, understanding the nuances of really how this all goes down. So together we have years and years of experience and familiarity with these problems.
Great. And you're not just a Seattle concern. You guys are you're looking out for everybody, right?
We are, yeah. We're actually geographically distributed. So okay. We have people in New York, people in Seattle and San Francisco right now, and we're, you know, the way we collaborate is like Skype. but we're really looking to help everyone.
So where do we find you online?
You go to commondataproject.org.
Okay. And yeah. You guys out on Twitter as well?
We are on Twitter, Common Data.
Okay.
On Twitter.
Just at Common Data?
That's our Twitter.
Okay. And what is it that you do with the Common Data Project?
I'm their senior program manager.
Okay.
So I work on strategic things, but also execution. So strategic and execution and planning.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, Becky Pesley.
Yes.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you,
Dave. Hope you enjoy the rest of the
conference. It was really nice meeting you. You too.
For more information about the Common Data Project, head to commondataproject.org or follow them on Twitter at Common Data. And next up, we've got Howard Freed of Secret 123.
Well, we're here after day two of PII 2010 with Howard Freed, who's one of the co-founders of Secret 123, and then also Barry Hurd, who is with 123 Social Media. And so here we go. First, Howard, you were telling us a little bit about this new release, Secret 123, what's that?
Dave, we're real excited. We just launched yesterday on Tuesday, and we're introducing a brand new product. It's called Secret 123. It's an add-in for Microsoft Outlook, and it's free. And basically, it adds a send secret button to your email program and scrambles your mail so nobody can read it except your intended recipient.
Okay. Is this using a PGP key? Or?
It uses similar cryptography. It uses PKI. But we're implementing industry standard certificates, X509 certificates. We use RSA 2048-bit encryption with AES 256, in case any of your listeners are curious. And we see the problem that we're solving for small business that is going to need to comply with state and federal legislation that is now on the books and in two states, Massachusetts and Nevada, and being drafted in 14 states last time I checked, which basically mandates use of encryption for email for all business. So this is taking the concept that kind of grew out of HIPAA and some of the compliance space, and now Massachusetts said if you're going to correspond electronically with one of our residents of Massachusetts, not just if you're a company in Massachusetts, and here's the rub. So if you have a business in California, and you have a customer in Massachusetts, you're now falling under the purview of this legislation.
Now, is this for publicly owned companies or?
No. This goes all the way down to the mom and pop small business. And there's fines and penalties, and this is going to really cause a forcing function. And most small businesses are just unaware that this is going to happen. And so we've been working for a couple of years, tracking the legislation, watching what's going on in the industry. And, you know, our timing hopefully is tied in right with the introduction. Massachusetts just recently enacted their legislation, and now it's in force. Nevada as well. And as I mentioned, a bunch of other states are on the way.
So for the small business gal who hasn't heard of this and they want to go look it up to see what their state's doing about it, what do you look for? Just email encryption or?
Email encryption. You'll probably find things like PGP and other of our competitors.
But I mean, like the legislation that's coming about, what's that called?
Oh, okay. You know? I don't have the actual draft in front of me, but if you Google Massachusetts privacy laws, for example, you'll probably come up with it. And I can follow up and we can put a link on the website for the listeners
to
the actual legislation.
Wow, I had no idea this is around the corner.
Yeah, so we think that the small business person will appreciate both getting coverage, you know, basically covering their butt, and also that it's free. So there's no burden, especially with this economy. There's no burden. They can use it themselves, and they don't have to pay to use it with other people. So it's free for everybody.
So, okay, am I going to be looking at ads now since it's free?
We are completely ad-free, no malware. We're not a trial. There's no fees. This is just pure goodness. So we're just giving it away.
Now, are you guys keeping a copy of my email or something?
No. As a matter of fact,
there's no free rides.
We don't actually, your email doesn't even go through our service.
Okay.
Your email goes through your email provider.
Okay.
The only thing that we're involved really is providing the public keys of those that you want to send to. So if you go to send to John at, you know, example.com and you don't have his public key to encrypt with, our software, the plugin right in Outlook, will go fetch that key and encrypt it. And it takes like a half a second. You don't even see it happen.
Okay.
So that's part of the simplicity that we built into the product so that regular business people who are not technology professionals can actually use powerful encryption.
So this is being encrypted at my Outlook on my computer before it goes out on the internet at all.
Exactly. It's called in the trade end-to-end encryption.
End-to-end.
Exactly.
Okay, now so what happens if let's say I send Barry an email and I use the
secret 123.
He gets it. If he has secret 123, he can see it. If not, he goes and downloads it for free and it's it.
And that's it.
Now can he take that email then and forward it to you?
Well, so a lot of people ask this question.
Okay.
It kind of gets into almost like a DRM area. You know, what permissions am I giving to that recipient? We don't get involved in that at all. We basically say once it's decrypted, it's yours to do with what you think is reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
So if you send something to Barry and he decrypts it, at that point, it's then like a regular email message. It's plain text. He can forward it. He can cut paste it into Word. He can do whatever he likes. There's no complication. And if Barry didn't have secret 123 yet, then it would still encrypt the message, but it would put a little clear text, and you can type a personal message above the encrypted message that says, here's the information I wanted to send you. If you can't view this, download the free plugin today, the free add-in today. And we support Microsoft Outlook 2003, 2007, 2010 today.
Mm-hmm.
And we plan on future versions to support other desktop mail and web mail and so on.
Now, okay, so like Gmail?
Sure. Okay. Gmail, Yahoo, AOL.
Gotcha.
We'll focus. The real difference between all those is really mostly the look and feel to the user.
Mm-hmm.
So the majors will probably skin it so it looks like the mail that they're used
sure.
to.
Yeah.
But there's probably, I don't know, thousands of web mail providers. We're never going to be able to customize all of them. So we'll have a version that gracefully degrades to work with most of them.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, great. So where do we find you online?
Secret123.com.
Okay. And are you guys on Twitter or anything like that? Or?
Secret123, at Secret123.
Okay. Okay, great.
And, please follow us. We're going to be starting up a blog in about 2 weeks. We're going to focus on just helping people, everyday people with everyday tips on how to be safe in their work and their correspondence. Protect their confidential information.
Outstanding. Well,
can I mention one other thing?
Oh, yeah, sure. What's up?
Great for lawyers. Great for accountants, finance people, bankers, doctors, healthcare.
Mm.
Really, really, really takes a puts peace of mind in their work.
Gotcha. Outstanding. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, dude.
All right. Well, I hope you enjoyed this special edition of the Social Expedition podcast, and I hope you will join us for Twilight Camp. That's this evening at 5:30. For more information, go to meetup.com/socialexpedition. It's free at Davis Kidd, so don't miss it. And then we've also got the breakfast on September 1st at 7:30 at the Holiday Inn at the University of Memphis. And our speaker this time is Chris O'Connor of Prodigy Arts. So that's going to be great. All right. See you next time. The Social Expedition podcast is produced at the offices of LunaWeb, a Memphis leader in web development and social media, online at lunaweb.com. LunaWeb is a full-service web agency meeting Memphis's online needs since 1995. Our theme music is The Year Before the War by Eric Maskell, available online at ericmaskell.com. For more information about the Social Expedition, including links mentioned during the podcast, visit socialexpedition.com. Thanks for listening.